It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we talk with a state lawmaker about a plan that would provide a financial incentive to some out-of-state students to stay in Wisconsin after they graduate. First, more than 4 million American kids were diagnosed with anxiety in 2016. Another nearly 2 million were diagnosed with depression. That's according to research from the Journal of Clinical Child and Adolescent Psychology, which also shows those numbers are steadily rising. Our next guest says that's a big problem and that as parents of those kids, we have the tools to fix it with more relaxed and less high-pressure parenting. Esther Wojcicki is an educator, journalist, and mother. Her latest book is How to Raise Successful People, Simple Lessons for Radical Results. Esther, thanks a lot for joining us today.
I'm honored to be here. Thank you so much for inviting me.
And you say you weren't always a Jedi master of a parent yourself. Can you talk about some of the anxiety you felt early on in your parenting career?
Well, I didn't have the world's best childhood myself, and I knew I didn't want to repeat it. And so I wanted to make sure that I could do something different for my children. And, you know, that alone is somewhat anxiety-producing. But what I did is make sure that I treated my children as somewhat, well, like little adults, let's put it that way. My number one goal was to teach them independence and to give them as many skills as they could possibly have to think early. So that was really important to me, and it was important, it turns out, in giving them a sense of confidence, which is what they have today. And I think that's what all parents want for their kids. They want their kids to feel happy and confident with what they are encountering in the world. And I did this by accident, by the way. You know, I wish I could say that I had pre-planned the whole thing, but I was just operating on my gut instincts. It's like, it has to be better than what I grew up with. And so I'm just going to do a childhood for them that I wish I would have had.
And you see another model of parenting, and you run into this a lot. You write as an educator, where parents are, for good motivations, they're worried about their kids' future. They want them to be successful. They want them to get to the good things in life. And they create a lot of high pressure and they do too much stuff for their kid. Talk about what's motivating us to move in that direction.
Well, I think we see a lot of risks and danger, and we don't see a clear path to where we want our kids to go. And so therefore, we tend to be helicopter parents. We tend to like overprotect and like, don't do this, we'll do this. And every day of the week is a different lesson because we want to make them really talented in all these different areas. And so what that does is it gives kids no free time and no agency. And then we do a lot of things for them, which is unfortunately the byproduct, but it's unintended, is that it disempowers them because they don't have choice. They don't tell you what they want to do. It's already pre-planned. And then also when we see kids doing something that we consider not okay or taking a path that we consider somewhat risky, we jump in and like, let me help you. And you know, kids learn by making mistakes, and the smaller the child, actually, the smaller the mistake, to be honest. And as they get older, the mistakes become a little bit more difficult, let's put it that way. But I think we need to give kids an opportunity to feel confident and make intelligent choices. And they only learn that by actually doing it and not by reading books about how to do it and not by listening to lectures about how to do it. They actually have to do it. So you can start early. I mean, like toddlers, they can do things like pick the clothes they want to wear that day or help you in the store, pick what kind of cereal they're going to have for breakfast tomorrow, or pick, have input into like which park do they want to go to today, as opposed to us making all those choices for them. Which what I'm suggesting is like little steps that are really easy to do that build a sense of confidence in your child. And I think we don't realize how important that is. And so we do it for them. We think we're doing them a favor, but we're not.
We're talking to Esther Wojcicki about her new book, How to Raise Successful People, Simple Lessons for Radical Results. Well, Esther, as a parent, I've always wished there was one simple trick as a parent. Well, you've got a trick that's actually a model. It's not one little step, but it's five big ones. It stands for trust, respect, independence, collaboration, and kindness. I want to talk about at least a couple of those today. Let's start with the T in trick, the trust. How do we build trust between ourselves and kids?
The first way that we do that is by giving them little opportunities to do things and trusting them to do it. They don't do it right, just say, oh, not a problem, just let's do it again. And so you're building trust, and in building this trust and respect, what happens is the kid wants to please you. All children really want to please their parents, in spite of what you might think. And as they build a sense of trust in themselves and respect, they don't want to lose that. They want you to see them as trustworthy. They want you to see them as good. They want you to be proud of them. And so these little things build up, and trust is really the key. And trusting yourself. When kids feel that the parents trust them, they tend to trust themselves. And so then they consistently pursue something. They develop what everybody wants them to, which is called grit. You know, they're like, oh, yes, I can do this. You know, my mom says, or I know, she doesn't have to say it, she feels it, that, you know, I'm really good at, I don't know, whatever it could be, building tree houses or building forts or playing soccer or whatever. Just those little things that we think are insignificant, they actually matter to little kids. And like I say, just asking them to help you do the shopping, I'll tell you, all little kids will be thrilled because no one asks them, right? We just run in the store, buy all the stuff, throw it in the shopping cart, and then tell the kids to, okay, time to check out. Come on over here, right? Mm-hmm. I think that's
yeah, we've been there.
I think that's what we're doing. So it's collaborative parenting is what I'm trying to talk about. Collaborate with your kids a little bit. You know, you don't have to do it 100% of the time. How about just small percentage of time? How about 20% of the time? Give them the opportunity to have some input. Or like, what do you want to do this weekend? Some ideas about, we always pick, right? What do you want to do? So my children always wanted to go to parks. And I can just tell you, I know every single park in San Francisco. I never would have done that myself.
Now, what about those moments when there's a violation of trust? The kid does something bad. You got to deal with it. How do you do that in a way that doesn't break down what you've spent so many years to build?
There are always going to be violations of trust. I mean, that's just life, unfortunately. And so I think the number one way to deal with that is discussion. And one of the ways that I do it in class, for example, because I have a lot of students, is that if there is a violation of trust, if they do something that is problematic, then I sit down, talk to them about it, and then I have them write about it. And I also had my children do it as well. They would write a little essay about what they had done, why they did it, and what they think the repercussions are, why it was perhaps not a good idea. And I want it to be reflective, because when they reflect, they think about it and perhaps they won't do it again. And I mean, kids don't do things really to be mean. They do things because they think it's best for them. And they have to realize that sometimes when you're doing things that you think are best for you, it might hurt other kids. And so, you know, you have to think about the repercussions. And by writing about it, they reflect. They think about it. And my daughters all, it's pretty funny, because when I was writing this book, my daughters, I asked them for some anecdotes, and they all whipped out their journals. And because I guess I spent a lot of time having them write journals. And it turns out that is a really great suggestion. I realized later on that a lot of therapists think about that as a way for kids and adults, actually, to reflect on their behavior.
We're talking to Esther Wojcicki. She's a teacher, a journalist, and a mom, and her new book is How to Raise Successful People, Simple Lessons for Radical Results. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Think about independence for kids. As a parent or as a kid, did you see a lot of those opportunities for independence for a kid to learn to make mistakes? If you're a teacher, do you see kids coming in being afraid of making mistakes, maybe being over-managed, over-guided by parents? What do you think of what our guest was just saying about building trust between parents and kids? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we continue our conversation with Esther Wojcicki about how to raise self-motivated and successful kids. Her new book is called How to Raise Successful People, Simple Lessons for Radical Results. You can join in at 800-642-1234. As a parent yourself, did you try to build some independence for your kids? Give them opportunities to do stuff, learn from their mistakes. Do you see too much helicopter parenting out there? Parents stepping in and fixing things when little things go wrong for their kids. What do you think about the ideas our guest is putting out there? Do you have questions for her? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. Stepping back a little bit, Esther, we mentioned anxiety at the outset there. And it seems like a lot of what you look at is a lot of parenting is kind of fear and anxiety based. Is this the moment that I'm going to screw things up for my kid if we don't do this thing? Are they going to get into the college we want? And then that leads to a lot of anxiety and fear for kids. You run into students, you write, that are just scared of making mistakes. Talk about this sort of fear-based approach to parenting.
Well, there's a lot of fear in parenting these days. And then even if you don't talk to your child about how fearful you are, they sense it. And there's a lot of anxiety. And I know just before this program started, there were statistics about depression and anxiety, and it's rising in kids. And so I think we need to relax and realize that every child is going to succeed no matter how much we worry about them. As a matter of fact, that worry is making us miserable and making our children miserable. And so I see this in the classroom, and a lot of teachers do. Like, for example, you know, in an English class, one of the problems that we have is that the kids turn out, they don't write the papers. We have a lot of parents that write the papers for the kids. And so how does that make the child feel? You know, they feel disempowered that, oh my God, I cannot write a paper by myself because, you know, I'm going to get a bad grade, so I need mom and dad to help me all the time. I mean, they don't say that, but that's the message. That's the hidden message that they're getting. So as a teacher, one of the things that I've done with that is I, instead of giving a grade on the first draft, I let them revise and revise, iterate over and over again until they get a good grade or the grade they want. So that takes a lot of the pressure off. And I think that can happen in all different subject areas to give kids an opportunity to do more of that revision. It's called mastery learning. And then the parents don't feel as responsible or obligated to step in and make sure they're getting, quote, the good grade that they're supposed to get in order to get into whatever college they're hoping for. So I think there's a lot of things in the school system that could change to make it less stressful for the kids and less stressful for the parents. And then I think the other thing parents need to do is to remember that their gut reaction is really the way that they should be guiding their kids. In other words, their gut reaction about what's going to make their child the happiest. And that doesn't mean looking to the left and to the right and saying, oh, well, Johnny on the right and Jeannie on the left are doing this. And not only that, they have this kind of score, or, you know, this one's potty trained and this one knows their ABCs and my kid still doesn't know anything. So they all develop at different rates, but I promise you, I've never been at a cocktail party where anybody's ever asked how old you were when you were potty trained.
Yeah, it'd be a weird one to come up. Now, Esther, some people are going to hear this and say, wait, this sounds like we're just being soft and lax on our kids. This is kind of an undisciplined approach. I'm guessing you've run into some version of that response. So what do you say to that concern?
I'm saying that we should still have standards. We're not giving up on the standards. I'm saying that we want to do this at least 20% of the time. Okay, so 80% of the time, if you really want to do, you know, your traditional parenting where you're directing everything, okay, continue with that if that is the way that you think it's going to be best. But you have to give your kids some opportunity for them to believe in themselves. And that's why I'm not being soft. I mean, I wasn't soft on my daughters, but I gave them a lot of choice. And by giving them a lot of choice and independence, they built a sense of independence in their own ability. They believed in themselves. And so if you just look at them today, I mean, Susan, as the CEO of YouTube, she's leading down a path. I mean, it's tough, you know, to be the CEO of a major company like that that's basically trying to democratize video for the world. And she has to believe in herself, and she's super ethical. You know, she's trying really hard to manage everybody's requests. But she couldn't do that if she was doubting herself all the time. And that's one of the things you want to do. You want to build into your children a sense of responsibility and a sense of belief in yourself and let them go. That's what, I mean, just look at all the amazing new companies that we have these days that are trying to help us lead a better life.
I want to bring on a caller now at 800-642-1234. Rena is with us in Milwaukee. Rena, hi.
Hi. I share the same kind of upbringing that she did. It wasn't anything I wanted to repeat with my children, but I wasn't a helicopter parent kind of a rebound. I didn't get involved with tattletaling unless I saw blood, a bump, or a bruise. I called it my 3B rule.
That's actually a really great rule. You know, if they cannot do things that harm, hurt in any way somebody else. But in addition to that, I would add to your 3B rule, bullying. Mm-hmm. So make it 4Bs, because no bullying is allowed either. And you don't want to be the kind of person that makes somebody else's life difficult.
Rena, thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Esther Wojcicki. Her new book is How to Raise Successful People, Simple Lessons for Radical Results. Along those lines, Esther, let's get to the K in your trick model, kindness. How can parents both teach and, I guess, more importantly, model kindness for their kids?
Well, I think you just hit on it by saying that very thing. That's how kids become kind, because they copy the model. So if you are kind, they will copy your kindness. And so if you see them being, you know, difficult or not kind, then you have to ask yourself, you know, what kind of a model have I set? And, there's a lot of different things that you can do to illustrate kindness. For example, I mean, at Thanksgiving time, we go to homeless rest shelters and, you know, hand out food. Some of my grandchildren have done that. And, I mean, just being kind on a daily basis means saying hello to people that, you know, you might not otherwise say hello to, people that work in your building or people at the school that, you know, are doing all kinds of important services to you. Just being friendly is an important thing for people. Saying hello to the cashier, you know, who checks you out at the grocery store. Those are all things that model a sense of community and kindness, and I think we can all do them, and it doesn't cost anything. It's super easy.
A question I have, we heard from Rena and from you, Esther, that you weren't 100% on board with the way your parents parented, and it can be really hard, I know, for people. Your parents are your model for your own parenting a lot of times. How can we make ourselves examine how we were brought up and then maybe learn from what didn't go so well?
Well, I had a tragedy in my childhood, which is what forced me into another entirely different model. And that was, I had another brother. There were three children, and my youngest brother was playing on the kitchen floor with a bottle of aspirin, and that was prior to the days when they had child safety caps on bottles of aspirin. And so he ate a lot of aspirin. And then my mother, being an immigrant, she didn't didn't trust herself. She didn't know what to do. And so she called the doctor, and the doctor clearly didn't listen because he told her to put him to bed and see how he was in a couple of hours. And if he would have thought and he would have listened, I'm sure he never would have said that. And my mother, being an immigrant, she did not trust herself. So she followed the instructions, and she did that, what he told her to. Of course, in 2 hours, he was violently ill. We went to a community hospital, had his stomach pumped, and then he was violently still ill. So we went around from hospital to hospital, but he wasn't accepted until the fourth hospital because we didn't have proof of payment. So it was a tragedy, and he died. And so what that showed me, actually, is trust yourself. If she would have trusted herself, and it also made me very skeptical of anybody that had a long title that gave me information that didn't make sense. And so that's what I wanted to make sure that my daughters, I said, they need to be able to think. The main thing is thinking and be able to, because I can't predict what's coming on in life, but what I can do is give them the tools to think and to trust their own gut instincts. And so that was my mantra when they were little. And that's why I changed the parenting that my parents had for me, because I was like, I do not want to repeat this. For me, it was a matter of life or death, right? Because if I didn't think carefully, something like that could happen again.
In our last minute or so, Esther, what are you hoping that parents or maybe future parents take home from your book?
Well, I would say the main thing, I would like to have them relax and give their child more trust, respect, independence, and stop doing things like this tragic college scandal where the real victims are the kids whose parents didn't trust them and believe in them and decided to hire somebody to cheat for them. A lot of these kids didn't even know this was happening. So I would like to say, your kid is going to be just fine. I've seen so many kids who at the age of 15 or 16, the parents are pulling their hair out. And at the age of 19 or 20, they're like, oh my God, whose kid is that? He's so great or she's so great. So they all develop at different rates. We just need to give them an opportunity and the support while they're developing.
Esther, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much for inviting me. I'm honored to be there. I love NPR, by the way.
That's great. That's Esther Wojcicki, educator and author of the new book, How to Raise Successful People, Simple Lessons for Radical Results. She was with us today to talk about why she thinks we need to trust our kids and respect their independence more, and that can make for more successful adults down the road. Too many students are graduating from Wisconsin schools and then getting out of town. That's according to our next guest, who says the state has a lot of untapped potential when it comes to out-of-state students coming to Wisconsin schools. State Assembly Representative Dave Murphy is a Republican who represents the 56th District, which includes Greenville. He co-sponsored a bill in the legislature that would offer grant money to out-of-state Wisconsin grads who stick around. He joins us now in our studio. Representative Murphy, thanks a lot for coming over.
Hi, and it's great to be here.
Now, talk about the problem first before we get into our legislation. Where do you see this untapped potential here for Wisconsin?
Well, certainly our growing economy has caused a need for more employees. Our businesses are shorthanded right now. So we want to attract more of these out-of-state students to stay here in Wisconsin. And right now, we only keep about 10% of those out-of-state students that graduate, and if we could increase that to 20 or 30%, it would be a tremendous benefit, and it would reduce the brain drain, and it would give our employers the opportunity to have more of these well-educated students working for them.
Yeah, and we hear this from businesses from time to time. What do you hear in your neck of the woods in the Fox Valley area? Do you see employers having trouble getting those skilled college degree employees?
Absolutely, Rob. There are businesses all over the Fox Valley as well as all over Wisconsin are looking for well-trained and more employees. There's a shortage everywhere.
Now, let's get in this legislation you're working on. What would it do?
So what we're trying to do is attract some of those out-of-state students by giving them a chance. We call it earned in-state tuition. Mm-hmm. So it would start actually 2 years after they graduate, they would have to be here. And then during a five-year period, they could earn up to 10% of the differential between out-of-state and in-state tuition. They can earn that back as a tax credit.
So it doesn't ultimately bring them back to having paid full or totally paid in-state tuition. It kind of splits the difference, it sounds like.
Yeah, and I'm glad you asked that, because it doesn't. Because if you're a parent of an in-state student, you might say, well, you know, why should these people get tuition as cheaply as my son or daughter? I've been paying taxes here for years. And they actually won't get all of that tuition back. But they have paid a lot of extra for that education in comparison to what in-state students do. And if they stay here for an extended period of time, we're trying to make those young people into Wisconsinites. Mm-hmm. And that's the real winning formula here for us.
And there's a work requirement, a salary requirement to be eligible for this. Is that right?
There is. And again, it's we're trying to attract students to careers. If we want to attract educated, highly trained individuals that can step into these really important jobs, that's what we're looking to do. And I think anybody who's graduating with a degree from our universities, that threshold shouldn't be that difficult to attain.
We're talking to State Assembly Representative Dave Murphy about legislation he is co-sponsoring that would give a credit to out-of-state students who come to Wisconsin and then stick around for more than a couple of years and get jobs here in the state. Can you talk about the price tag? What would this cost Wisconsin?
So we are allocating $15 million in this bill to operate this program. For a particular student, the credit's going to be over 5 years. It would be substantial. It could be in the $10,000 a year range to a student.
And are you hearing a lot of bipartisan support for this kind of idea?
You know, actually, I'm seeing a lot of bipartisan support. In the people that I talk to, I can't say that liberals or conservatives are either for it or against it. I see some on both sides being for it. I see people on both sides having questions about it also. You know, people question, is this the best way to spend the money? I have no other idea on how to attract this large group of out-of-state students, only 10% of which now stay in the state. And I'm trying to figure out a way to get this 90%, at least a portion of them, to hang on here.
Yeah, people talk about lifestyle, amenities. Do you see ways to kind of sell the Wisconsin way of life to some of these students while we've got them as a captive audience for 4 or 5 years?
You know, I think, Rob, that certainly is another aspect to this. If you say, well, are there other ways to get them to stay here? I think there are. You work on a bill and you try to focus on what you're doing. And so I have this bill, and so I'm kind of focusing in on that right now. But, you know, I'm always happy to hear from people with other ideas that they may have.
Yeah, would employers be looped into under this bill and be let know that, hey, here's this potential hiring pool for you?
Well, one of the interesting things is the Wisconsin Economic Development Association is one of the groups that has really been championing this legislation. And one of their ideas that we added into the bill was to allow employers to advertise and to designate themselves as employers that are trying to seek these out-of-state kids to come in and work for them.
And which campuses do you think might be most affected by this? I'm guessing UW-Madison is a big part of our out-of-state pool here.
Sure. I mean, Madison is always going to be a big part of this. But, you know, our campuses, you know, Platteville, I think, would be a big part of it. I could see La Crosse. I could see River Falls and Stout, UW-Milwaukee, because of our agreement with Illinois. And Parkside, even, they bring in a fair amount of out-of-state students.
I was just in La Crosse last week and talked to a local business development leader who said he had an anecdote about somebody talking to a bunch of UW La Crosse students and asking, you know, how many of you are planning to stay in this area after you graduate? And only a couple hands came up. Is it your hope that if this passes and we ask that kind of question in 5 years, we'll see more of those hands go up?
Absolutely. I mean, that would be to me, what tells me that we did the right thing and that it's working. Yeah.
What's the timeline now in this legislation? Where is it in the process?
So we're going to ask for a hearing on this bill, and I would expect that we would do that sometime this summer. Hopefully, we would be able to maybe get it on the assembly calendar for a vote in the fall. And so that would sort of be the timeline that we'd be looking for.
And if that happened, if all went well and it got passed in the fall, when would this actually kick in? When would this take effect as it's written right now?
Well, because you have that two-year period in there where students couldn't start earning the credit until 2 years after they graduate, that sort of is, it does give us some time to put this in place and sort of get the structure of it implemented.
We heard from a listener, Charlie in Milwaukee, who says, why are we trying to attract out-of-state students when there's plenty of in-state students denied access to UW-Madison as well as other state colleges? So maybe we should focus on the local students more, he says.
Well, our problem is not that a lot of our in-state students aren't being granted access. Our enrollments are actually declining. And so the demographics going forward aren't positive for filling these job needs. And so I would tell Charlie that, you know, if I could find enough in-state students, I would be happier than heck. But I don't see how that happens. We just do not have the numbers coming out of our high schools.
We'll leave it there for now. Representative Murphy, thanks again for coming over here.
Thank you.
That's Dave Murphy, Republican state representative from Greenville. He joined us to look at a bill that would offer a financial incentive to out-of-state students to remain in Wisconsin after they graduate. Vice President Mike Pence visited Eau Claire today to promote the latest trade deal that will replace NAFTA. His visit comes at a time of increased tensions between the U.S. and China. As a quick refresher, the U.S. and China have placed retaliatory tariffs on goods exported by each country. The Trump administration placed $200 billion in additional tariffs on Chinese goods last week. China announced it's going to place an additional $60 billion in tariffs on U.S. goods this week. Those tariffs have had a significant impact on Wisconsin's dairy industry. Experts warn that the state could feel the impact for years to come. Mike North is the president and founder of the Platteville-based Commodity Risk Management Group. Mike, welcome back to Central Time.
Good to be joining you.
Well, we've talked to you in the past, Mike, about some of the general problems facing the dairy business and dairy farmers here in Wisconsin. What is the impact of these tariffs now, these back-and-forth tariffs with China?
Well, the Chinese story is an interesting one because if you examine our exports to the Chinese, as a country, the number one thing we export to them is milk powder. The second thing is whey. And, you know, as we talk about what's been going on with regard to those particular products, they haven't slowed down much by way of their purchases. It has been some. There's no question about that. And that's been actually amplified recently by the African swine fever. For those that don't know, whey is sent to China largely for the use of feeding nursery pigs, and due to the depopulation of their sow herd, and estimates vary, but anywhere from 13 to 19% of the sow herd has been reduced due to the disease. There are fewer nursery pigs to consume whey. That whey consumption has fallen dramatically. And then, of course, you throw into the mix the tariff conversation, whey consumption has dropped. And so the impact on whey prices has been very significant. Prices have come down approximately 45 to 50% over the course of the last 5 months. But again, that's a multifaceted issue. And, you know, as we talk about, you know, Wisconsin's mainstay, that being cheese, the Chinese story doesn't play into that much. We have sold them some, but that's not the primary ingredient that leaves this country headed for China. Most products that we do sell them are, in fact, ingredient-based, not the finished goods that we often think of. So the cheese that we make here in the state of Wisconsin isn't often front and center in that discussion. That's more of a Mexico discussion, to be frank.
And I think when people think of dairy farming, they think, okay, it's the milk on the local store shelf or the cheese that they buy at the store. I think of it as a local industry. Big picture, how much does Wisconsin dairy rely on the export market?
Well, it's a ripple effect because milk moves freely around the country from areas of surplus to areas of deficit. So it's tough to spell out specifically how much Wisconsin on its own relies on the export market. But if you were to look at the national scene, mm-hmm. One day each week, the milk produced that day leaves this country. Last year, 15.8% of all of the milk produced left the country in one way, shape, or form. And so as you talk about milk being a product that moves easily around the country, if we weren't exporting it out of some port in some form, regardless of what the product is, that milk would have to find a home immediately in our domestic market. So Wisconsin, together with dairymen around the country, depend very heavily on exports. And as we've watched the export participation of our producers grow, and it's grown sizably, if you go back 15 years ago, only about 5% of our milk left the country. Today, that's 15. So participation has tripled in the course of that time.
Talking to Mike North, president, founder of the Platteville-based Commodity Risk Management Group, about the dairy industry and international trade. You mentioned Mexico, and we mentioned Vice President Mike Pence was in Wisconsin today promoting the new U.S.-Mexico-Canada trade agreement, the new version of NAFTA. That's not, as I understand it, ratified by the legislatures of those three countries. We have an agreement, but that's not in effect yet. But how, if it came into effect, how would that affect the dairy industry and our exports to Canada and Mexico?
So Mexico, as a trading partner in the dairy space, is quite easily our largest trading partner, nearly twice that of the next destination. And you know, even there, the next destination, if you will, is Southeast Asia, which is a group of countries. So there isn't a country that comes close to Mexico in their purchase of U.S. dairy. And they buy everything. They buy powder. They buy whey. They buy cheese. They buy a vast array of U.S. dairy products. And when we do talk about Wisconsin and its participation in the export market, our relationship with Mexico is pretty important because this is a place where we do actually get to export a fair volume of cheese. And when you look at the United States, only about 5% of our cheese actually gets exported. But of that 5%, a big part of that comes out of Wisconsin. So when the steel and aluminum tariffs were enacted, the retaliatory tariff that Mexico immediately replied was on our cheese. A 25% tariff was applied to that, and in the end, it has backed up the flow of cheese that would have normally left the state or the country, and now it's finding its way into warehouses domestically, requiring U.S. consumers to make up the difference.
Now, some people look at low dairy prices, difficulty fighting export markets with these tariff wars, and say, well, the problem is overproduction. We're just producing too much raw milk, and that's driving the problems. What do you say to that?
Well, the reality of overproduction is this. If you go back to 2013, 2014, as our exports continued to grow, we continued to grow our milk production at a fairly steady rate. And in the end, we haven't really changed that. That big signal to provide more dairy to the world was met by U.S., but it was also then met by other producers around the world. And as it is, we've moved to a place where this new tariff issue has curtailed even more of our product export flow, and that's showing up in the warehouses. We've not really changed our growth rate in terms of added milk supply in this country, but we have seen ebbs and flows in demand. Here's the problem. You can't just flip a switch on a cow to turn milk production on and then turn milk production off. And so as we talk about this continued growth rate that we've had, it's been a natural function of the normal growth in cow efficiency. That's been most of it. But we've also continued to see, you know, some reinvestment into the dairy space. So it's not that we've gone hog wild and oversupplied the market. We've done what we've always done. And because we've had the ebb and flow in demand, we've seen this backup of supply. And yes, now it seems as if we have this, you know, massive oversupply, but it wasn't because, you know, we just went crazy producing extra milk. It was because we've seen, you know, these big signals for more demand come into our market, be answered by producers, and then, you know, flatten out or leave the market only to, you know, wait for that signal to come again. So it's a little bit of a kind of a back and forth lead and lag type of relationship between supply growth and demand growth.
Stepping away from the dairy industry for a minute, I want to ask about how Chinese tariffs have affected other agricultural businesses in Wisconsin. We had a caller, actually a soybean farmer, calling from his tractor saying he's really worried about what these are going to mean, not just now, but if, say, China finds different suppliers and sticks with them in the future. What are you seeing in other non-dairy markets?
Well, at the top of the list in terms of the pushback on agricultural products would be soybeans and pork. And as you talk about the Chinese story, there's no wonder as to why there was a larger and somewhat disproportionate share of last year's tariff relief aimed at soybean producers than at other commodities. Many will argue as to the fairness of how that was constructed, but it really was a function of the disproportionate effect on some of these other markets. But as we talk about soybeans specifically, there is no question that the Chinese trade is important to our soybean farmer. If you look at raw soybean or soybean products, over half of the soybeans in this country leave for the export market, and China is the vast purchaser of those products. They buy over two-thirds of all of the soybeans that are traded in the world. And we're one of the largest participants in that market. So as we talk about the loss of Chinese trade from our country, indeed, because of their demand for protein, which has been curtailed some this year as well because of the declining sow and greater declining hog herd on the heels of African swine fever, China has had to go to other sources to find that product. There is a legitimate concern about whether or not those stronger relationships, because they've continued to buy soybeans from other markets. In fact, if you look at the South American market as a whole, they sell more soybeans to the Chinese annually than we do. And so it wouldn't be fair for us to say that we were the main supplier, because we're not. But the concern is that the relationship between countries like Brazil and Argentina mostly, and secondarily places like Uruguay and Paraguay, if those relationships grow greater, it does put us in a really difficult position to go back in and try to regain that lost market share, especially as we find ways to be more efficient with our land and our resources and grow more soybeans domestically. So it does put us in a hard spot if we can't repair that relationship and get back out in front of this after the dust settles from the tariff discussion.
Mike, thanks a lot for joining us again today.
My pleasure.
That's Mike North, president and founder of the Platteville-based Commodity Risk Management Group. He joined us today to talk about the ongoing trade war between U.S. and China and the long-term effects it could have on agricultural industries here in Wisconsin, dairy, soy, and beyond. If this is a story that's affecting you personally, we'd love to hear your take on it, your story, your thoughts about U.S. policy. You can email us. Our email address is ideas@WPR.org, or you can tweet us at Central Time WPR. Time for a roundup now of weird food stories out there in the news. Yesterday was National Chocolate Chip Cookie Day, for one. I celebrated by eating a chocolate chip cookie, and then later I ate another one. So I celebrated twice, which makes up for today. It's National Barbecue Day. I have not had barbecue yet. I don't think I'm going to have time to make any tonight. Maybe I'll catch up with that this weekend. Also, if you're making summer vacation plans, how about a Taco Bell-themed hotel and resort? The fast food chain announced that it's opening The Bell in California for a limited time only. It will be a hotel experience, quote, inspired by tacos and fueled by fans. I'm wondering if there was a big hue and cry looking for a Taco Bell-themed hotel and resort. I don't know. Maybe. Also in the news, some restaurants let you bring in your own booze. Some will let you bring in a cake, you know, for your birthday party. A restaurant in London is trying a new model. You bring your own table. It's a limited seating pop-up restaurant, and you and your friends have to bring in a table. Or you can make a donation to a campaign against loneliness. Okay, so maybe there's a cause behind that. Finally, tomorrow on Food Friday, this is a weird one to me. It took some persuading. We're going to talk about cooking with buttermilk. I never do, but apparently you can do a lot with it. If you're a buttermilk fan, set me straight right now. Send an email to ideas@wpr.org. Tell me how wrong I am to doubt the power of buttermilk. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.